Get after it, PDX. In-depth conversations with inspiring people in the creative hotbed of Portland, Oregon, and beyond. Now, let's welcome the host of Get After It PDX and the co-founder of Y East Wolfpack, Willie McBride.
Hey folks, a quick word about our sponsors. The Amesir Distilling Company, a new distillery focused on bringing people together through great flavors and a warm environment. They love the way spirits taste, but more importantly, they love that they bring people together to make memories, build bridges, and crystallize the moment. Opening in spring 2020 in Northeast Portland. Today's episode is also brought to you by Daybreak Racing, a Portland, Oregon company offering some of the finest trail running events and trail stewardship opportunities available today. Daybreak Racing has been uniting the adventurous and wild-hearted with the mountain, coast, and forest trails of the Pacific Northwest since 2016. Adventure begins at Daybreak. Visit them at daybreakracing.com.
Welcome, folks. We are back with another episode of Get After It PDX. Today we have a special edition episode with a former very special guest, Faith Briggs, who is a filmmaker and runner and outdoor adventurer. She was on episode 4, so back in the day, one of the original guests here. So today she is back to talk about some very important and sort of sobering, very real issues that go on in our country all the time, and recently got a bunch of press with a case of Ahmaud Arbery. So she's here to discuss these things with us and jump into the conversation. So thank you for being here, Faith.
Thank you. Yeah, no, thanks for having this really important conversation.
So, you know, this case of a 25-year-old African-American man who was out for a run through a neighborhood right by his own, and essentially a father and son, two white men, say they thought he was a suspect of a supposed robbery, local break-ins, and confronted him with guns, and basically he was shot dead. And so this has gotten a ton of press recently, but the most notable thing was it took a long time, 2 months, where there was no action taken in terms of justice, no arrests made, 2 months until it started getting some of the press it deserved. And so for a lot of people, they might feel like this is maybe one of the first instances like this that they've paid attention to, or, and so maybe they don't think stuff like this happens all that much, but of course it does. Horrible murder of people of color happen all the time by law enforcement. You know, this is not an uncommon occurrence, but why, what do you think has changed in your mind for some of these cases to be getting more recognition now than they once might have?
I believe that one of the big differences is the advent of cell phone video, means that, and this understanding that, like, that is the proof that this happens all the time. And that, you know, in my mind, or let me start over a little bit. Sorry. I didn't watch the video of Ahmaud Arbery being shot. And I can't watch it. And you know, this morning I was scrolling on Instagram, completely separate, just like while I was making food, and I saw a video of another young black man being punched by the police in Buffalo, New York, and I was upset. His name was Quentin Settles. But I was upset because I didn't want to see it. Like, I used to, you know, from 2012 to 2015, the Black Lives Matter movement was basically birthed into being. And it was this widespread, organized outrage saying, like, enough is enough. we have the evidence. It's these cell phone videos. We know what happened. And yet when these young black men and women are shot down in the street, either by police officers, despite not being found guilty of any crime and not being the aggressors in the situations, or by these vigilante citizens who are like deciding that they should be patrolling neighborhoods and deciding who is a criminal and who isn't, with a complete lack of evidence. Like, I think that the cell phone videos made a huge difference, because it felt like now we had the proof. What's been interesting and heartbreaking is that when it comes down to accountability, the cell phone videos don't matter. It doesn't make a difference. And we've seen some change, you know, from 2012 to 2020 to 2020. But when Trayvon Martin was killed, George Zimmerman, who was this vigilante, he was acquitted. And the same thing happened when Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown. And I mean, that story is so common when it comes to a black person who is sometimes walking in the street, sometimes sitting in their home, sometimes, you know, broken down on the side of the road waiting for help because something happened to their car, sometimes pulled over in a, you know, like casual traffic incident, like a headlight, you know, like mundane everyday things happen and suddenly they're dead. And that is a pattern. So I don't know, I guess to answer your question, the videos have changed. And the witnessing of black death is more common now for more people because the videos exist. I guess that's really what I want to say, is that growing up African American, I learned that I had to really have a more careful fear of police than other people, just based on the way that I looked. And I learned that from my dad, you know. And it was just kind of part of the conversation that I grew up around. But I think that it being more people being able to witness it, not that it's a fucking privilege, it's not a privilege, right, to be witnessing this, but we have to see it. It makes it harder for more people to ignore it. But a lot of people still ignore it. They still find it easier to say that the cops were probably just trying to do their job and that person was probably obstructing justice and, you know, mistakes were made and they're regrettable, but they're justifiable. That's a much easier response for most people.
It's obviously, as a white person myself, it is just, it's actually something that I do try to think about and do think about all the time. But of course, it's impossible to know what it's actually like. But just the thought of living in this country and that the very people who are meant to serve and protect you might end up killing you at a traffic stop, at a basically any time when you're doing nothing and you're going about your day-to-day life as an innocent, upstanding citizen. Like, trying to comprehend that is just, it's impossible. It's
definitely impossible without historical context. And I think that's what I've been really thinking a lot about this week, is like, most people don't. So I studied African American studies and film studies in undergrad. And so, like, I spent a lot of time learning about the history of Black culture in America, including legislation. And historically, you know, the policing of Black bodies is like, it's as American as baseball. Like, it's like the most American thing, you know, to figure out how are we going to control Black America. And it starts in slavery, obviously. And then after slavery, there's this really important period of time called Reconstruction, where you have 4 million free Black people who, you know, so Civil War ends, Emancipation Proclamation happens, the Northern troops are occupying the South, and essentially Reconstruction is from 1865 until 1877, when there's something called the Compromise of 1877. But during that era known as Reconstruction, Black people were, there were all these conversations about 40 acres and a mule, right? What do we do to help stabilize people who we had enslaved and now own nothing? What do we do with free Black people? So they start like being able to get elected and being able to own businesses and being able to own some properties. Obviously, everything's still extremely racist, but this period is so, has so much potential. And then the Compromise of 1877 is basically saying, we want to keep a Republican. This was at the time the party of Abraham Lincoln. We want to keep a Republican in the presidency. It's really close. We might not be able to get this person, Hayes, elected. And it might go to, I believe the Democrat Southerner was named Tilden, but I'm not totally sure on that. It might go to this Southern Democrat. We'll bargain. And so the bargain was, we'll pull out the Northern troops. You won't have to, and you'll be able to deal with the problem of what to do with these free Black people yourselves without this Northern oversight. That was the bargain that was made in 1877. And immediately you get the Black codes and you get this Jim Crow era where loitering, so basically walking down the street, became illegal. And so you would be forced into work, and you would sometimes, in some states, I think South Carolina and Mississippi were the first states to start this, you would have to walk around with proof of employment. So you couldn't actually make real money, but you had to show that you were working for a white person. If you didn't, and you had your own business of some kind, you had to pay like these huge taxes. So basically, not being able to enslave Black people and have the labor, what they did was force them into low-paying work for white people who had previously been the slave owners.
So instead of being their own business owners, because they would just get taxed exorbitant amounts, they instead had to take shitty jobs for white people.
Exactly. So they couldn't work for themselves unless they were able to make so much money that they were able to pay these exorbitant taxes. And if that happened, very often, their farms would be burned down. They'd be like, oh, they said something bad to so-and-so, and their farm would be burned down. And we have, I think, 57, which doesn't sound like a lot, but if you can think about how many people actually owned their land, but we have like 57 counts of loss of land through violence that are like accounted in that way. And then the large majority of land is lost through over time from I think it was like 14% of agricultural land was owned by Black people right after Reconstruction, and now it's like 1-2%. And that happened via racism at the USDA over the last however many years, and that's still happening now. But you know, so basically the Jim Crow era made loitering or like walking freely illegal. And then, you know, we have these vestiges of that have existed since. So who can hang out on the street and be seen as innocent versus who can hang out on the street and be seen as somehow guilty? Those were laws that were enacted. So when we see police like still having some of that historic ideology that says that body is dangerous, that one is not, it comes from like how our laws were created. And a lot of those Jim Crow era laws lasted until the 1960s and the Civil Rights Act. But that wasn't that long ago. And at that point, you have all this other stuff, redlining, who gets to live where, what neighborhoods can Black people walk through and what neighborhoods can't they walk through? Where are they supposed to be? You know, so this idea of like a Black body could be in the wrong place is still really like, it's really prominent still in just terms of like how America works every day.
Let's tie that into, of course, then running and exercising while Black and moving around as a person of color. What is, I mean, I'm sure, of course, you experience that all the time. What is that like?
Yeah.
Being in a neighborhood and being looked at and being, I just read something the other day on social media. This person, of course, in response to the Ahmaud Arbery case, had written a short piece sort of about just the experience of walking through a neighborhood as a Black male. And, you know, the cops pull by him and they drive real slow, and you know, when they look at him, they don't smile and they just stare him down and they circle the block and just, you know, it's like letting him know that like he is not welcome there through all these subtle or not so subtle gestures and just like the impact of that. So tell us your take.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was so, it's so interesting when I lived in New York and ran with a running crew, Black Roses NYC. And, you know, when I wasn't running with them, I'd go up to Harlem and I'd run with Harlem Runner. I'd go up to Washington Heights and hang out and run with, we run Uptown, Rue Crew. We'd run with Bridge Runners downtown, you know, and you were in these huge groups. And I don't think I ever articulated it in my head at that time of safety in numbers, because I was just running with my friends. But in light of this, I look at it and I'm like, oh, that's also what we were doing, was creating safety in numbers, to say like, you might be able to sneakily shoot one of us, but can you do it when there's 50 of us around, you know? So that act of like taking up space in a way that you're not seen, like exercising isn't a crime, right? And if Black bodies are viewed with suspicion and criminalized constantly, like, oh, I see that person walking in this neighborhood, they must be up to no good, when that person's jogging or like running, you know, in sneakers and spandex and a sports bra, clearly running, you're like, I don't know how to regard this body, you know? I don't know. There's actually nothing suspicious about what they're doing, just their skin color is suspicious. And we're also not used to seeing, you know, Black bodies moving recreationally because of the disenfranchisement of our communities, where we have the least access to healthcare, the least access to healthy food. So like to be taking care of yourself is also this really radical act, as is running. So going on a run as a person of color in this country is super radical, to every day say, I'm going to take care of this body that is seen as suspicious, is seen as criminal, is seen as scary, is really like an incredible thing to be able to do.
Well, it goes back to a lot of the work you do, of course. One thing was reminding me of Brotherhood of Skiing, is that in that movie, which you produced, wonderful film, talking about the part of the reason for starting that ski club was, again, safety in numbers and having a bigger presence to feel safe in these all white spaces at these ski resorts.
Absolutely.
And just representation in general, of course, of if there isn't a precedent being shown to young people of people of color going for runs or doing these things that may feel inaccessible, then they're not going to follow suit.
Yeah. Well, it also goes back to, like the privilege of having time, and then like what you can do with that time. So I don't know. I think when people are always like, oh my God, you were running in New York City. That must have been so miserable. When I live out on the West Coast now and they're so used to like trails and they're like, oh, I just can't run in the city. And I'm like, miserable. It was amazing. Like, are you kidding me? Do you know what I got to see? Like block yeah. to block, neighborhood to neighborhood, like culture and barbecues and music and bodegas and people playing dominoes and people cutting up coconuts and like everything was happening. You know, everything was happening all the time. And those sights to me are just as incredible to see as some of the incredible vistas I get to see when I'm out on these trails. But they're not seen as being as special or seen as being as important. And so it just goes back to like, I don't know, this cultural idea of like what's cool. What's good? What's valuable? What's not? And who gets to be where? And I do think like, I don't know, when you were talking about Brothers of Skiing, it made me think of like this idea of the term othering, right? So like you other a person, you make them different. So they're the other, they're the thing that you don't understand, the thing you don't know about, the thing you're unfamiliar with. Or like another term that people use is like making strange. And that happens a lot when, you know, it has happened a lot because of segregation in our communities and across our country. And so, you know, like we said, like that was legal for such a long time that there's vestiges of that exist in neighborhoods. And so if you didn't grow up around anyone that didn't look like you, it's very easy to other those people. And so to kind of believe what you see on TV, you know, who you see are the criminals and who you see are the heroes and who are the, you know, heroines in the books that we read about and who is not. And so I think that we live in this country where we're taught unconscious bias, even to the point where it exists within communities of color and how we regard ourselves. There's a crisis of self-esteem in a lot of communities of color because of what we're taught about ourselves constantly. And so once again, like if you're a runner and you know that running makes you feel good and running makes you feel powerful and running makes you feel accomplished, to have messaging daily tell you that you're not those things, but then to walk out of the house and reclaim that and be those things is really, it's really incredible. And it's really, I don't know, for me to think that like Ahmaud Arbery was making a choice to go be powerful and be full of self-love and self-care, which is what you do when you leave the house on a run. And was killed for it. It makes me so sad. And it makes me so sad because he's also this like former high school athlete. And so many of us have done the transition from being like a high school athlete, a college athlete, where your life is and the discipline that you learn and all of the structure comes from being part of a team. And when that team goes away, it's really hard to transition into some kind of like healthy routine without having a coach to tell you how to do it or without having the same teammates and the same camaraderie to go do it. And I think like being able to find something to fall in love with again, in my case, going from college track and then finding longer distance running and falling in love with that was really life-giving in terms of my like mental health and my sense of self. And if high school students or if graduates see what happened to Ahmaud Arbery and they're like, I'm not going out on a run. You know, it's like the next generation of this like big group identity that we call runners, which is like, I don't know the numbers on how many people self-identify as runners in America. I know it's huge. I don't know if you know, but that future growth is like curtailed in a moment like this because it's not safe for some people to identify as runners and to go and do that. Is what we're told.
It's a crazy time, of course, in general, you know, with pandemic going on and all this stuff, and that running is actually due to the ability to do it with relatively little gear, just a pair of shoes, essentially, you can do it on your own, you can do it from your doorstep, is running is sort of having this resurgence.
Totally.
And I was going to say, to tie this in, is that, I mean, clearly it had a huge impact, but what is your sort of take on the fact that because this terrible thing happened while he was out for a run, that this massive community of runners, you know, road runners, trail runners, this huge, huge masses, were actually able to connect with this case, whereas very possibly it might have just slipped by otherwise.
Totally, yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think it's hugely important. And I'm so, so glad that the running community is responding. Because, so the difference is, like, people don't really, like, when they talk about themselves, they're not like, I'm a teacher, I'm a filmmaker, and I'm a driver, right? Meaning, like, I drive in my car. So when someone is killed driving in their car, it's not as if there's, like, all the drivers are going to, like, stand up and be like, this is unacceptable. This is our identity itself. It's our freedom that is under attack here. And so often, like, standing on the street corner, like, people don't, like, I stand on the street corner, like, which some people do. And it's like, but it's actually something strange that I really miss about New York, is the amount of people who were just outside in their neighborhoods. And it's something that when I'm running around here, I miss being able to see people, like, living their lives out in public space. But what I got distracted, but the identity of being a runner is I can walk out of my house, I can run, and that's who I am. It's what I stand for. Somehow it's this, like, statement. You know, we got endorphins from that. Our serotonin levels are popping. We're just like, yes, running is everything. And then to have someone killed while running, while seeking this experience that we seek also, makes it more personal, I think, for a lot of people than it's ever been before, because they can finally put themselves in those shoes. Whereas opposed to in a lot of cases, people haven't been able to put themselves in the shoes of these victims, of these people who have been killed. But I think the importance of this act of running means that a lot more people are outraged. But it can't just be outrage about Ahmaud Arbery. You know, I think hopefully Ahmaud Arbery's death is a wake-up call to a lot of people to say, oh, there are innocent people being shot down by freaking random people. This is the other thing. Like, it's not even like these were cops patrolling and there was somehow some kind of mistake, which is what we always wish away and how people don't get held accountable for their actions. But this was two random dudes. Like, yeah, off-duty cop, but this is, like, it's just crazy to me. And hopefully it's crazy enough finally for people to say, like, this is not okay anymore.
Well, just inconceivable that it 2 months. I mean, think about, like, his mother. Like, 2 months have gone by and nothing, literally nothing has happened. Like, what sort of emotions must you be feeling then? It's just like nothing happened.
Well, and it also shows proof that it matters when there's outcry. Like, if there is not outcry, it's a lot easier to sweep this stuff under the rug. But when there is outcry, people have to pay attention. And the outcry can't just be like posting on social media, even though that's also really important because it says to people, I care about this thing. But it also needs to be writing to your Congress people and showing up and being like, hey, what's this law that exists? Or I don't think the stand your ground thing is cool. Like, we need to change that. You know, like, I very much believe that contacting local officials and representatives about this is really really important. Like, we need to be a thorn in their sides where they can't get through a day without someone saying, what are you going to do about this? Without multiple people saying, what are you doing about this? Like, and it just hasn't been that way. Like, we haven't had that. We haven't had that tipping point in this country yet for it to matter enough for it to change.
And just also that we need to, like in this instance specifically, that an arrest obviously is not a conviction, that this is just part of this process of like people need to stay on the case, keep paying attention to it, see what's going on. Yeah.
It means a lot. And the thing is, like, it doesn't have to be a one-off, you know? Like, you can make a 2.23 mile run a part of your routine, you know? You can do one of those a week, one of those a month. You can run for and raise awareness about a Black person who was killed via law enforcement and that person was not held accountable. You could do that monthly, weekly. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people.
Do that every day for like, many, many... Sadly,
there are a lot of people that you could run for, you know, and I've been thinking about that this week, you know, in terms of all the things that we run for and all the things that we raise money for and all the races that exist and what we support through our like mass movement, a literal mass movement of like, you know, breast cancer awareness, suicide prevention, lupus, these are all really important causes that we as runners have been able to. I mean, you guys at Y East doing these vertical challenges have been able to raise thousands and thousands of dollars for COVID relief. Just being like, we are going to do something and stand for something through our movement. And that's incredibly powerful. And how do we take that same fervor and put it behind social justice movements? I definitely wonder about that. And I've seen such powerful examples of people using their running to stand for something more important. There's a runner, Jordan, her last name I'm losing right now, but she runs to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women. And she ran the Boston Marathon with this red handprint across her face.
Yeah.
And people were like, what is this? What's going on here? But so many more people knew what that was because of that choice. And we can do that, you know. But I think it's just easier for us to not have to look at injustice and say that it is a collective responsibility. Like, we don't live in a perfect country that's just going to change because politicians are going to change it. I think we should know that by now, but like, I think sometimes we go through our daily lives, particularly when we don't walk around daily in these politicized bodies and we haven't grown up being told like the personal is political and like, this is just the facts of life. Like, we think that something wrong will happen and a new law will be created and it will be fixed. And that doesn't have anything to do with us and that process doesn't have anything to do with us. And that is just not how our government or our country has ever worked. Like, we know that. Laws are a response.
Yeah, it's obviously an uncomfortable process to acknowledge and the fact that these things happen all the time, that every day things like this are going on. You know, I follow Sean King, who obviously was a huge force behind the Ahmaud Arbery case and getting that, the exposure it got. And, you know, it's definitely, like you said, like the video of the young man in Buffalo getting punched in the face by this police officer. I woke up this morning and scrolling through social media and watch that, and you know, it's shocking and painful, but you also, I don't think the solution is just to not ever look at that stuff or to try to put it out of your head. Like, you want to figure out how to hopefully be productive with seeing something like that and make it motivate you to do something that might help with making some sort of change and not just cripple you with depression or something. But trying to fool yourself and just not think about things like that happening. Because again, putting that out of your head is a privilege. Like that just being on your social media and not being your reality is a privilege, of course.
Yes.
So very complex.
It is so complex. And I think it's so much easier for us to look at other places and other countries and be like, look what's happening there. Look at that and not look at what's happening in our own backyard. And Sean King, I mean, I was thinking specifically about Sean King the other day because he does use his platform to bring so much awareness and to just say, like, we as a public can push this needle by organizing en masse. And so he's often, like, lending himself as a mouthpiece and more than that, but I mean, like, as a amplifier to what's going on so that people can learn what's happening in all these different communities and add their voice to the voices in those communities, to that mom's voice for 2 months, you know, by herself, suddenly to have 500,000 people running in honor of her son. That does push the needle. And I was thinking about how hard it is to have to watch those videos and have to talk about those things every day. I was in an exhibit called Respond in, I want to say 2014 or 2015, where this gallery pushed all of their shows and created a 2-week exhibit and asked artists to submit work in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I created a video animation called Black Man, which was spelled like Pac-Man, and it was a Pac-Man where the Black Pac-Man was eating something different and being chased by something different in each era, going from slavery to now. And when I went to the exhibit, I think what struck me the most was the amount of time that the artist had spent responding, like looking at these faces, drawing these people, learning these names, relearning these names, learning these stories, like for the sake of raising their voice, sitting in all of this pain and this hurt and this brutal, horrific reality in order to raise that awareness and be that amplifying voice. I just to say, like, this isn't comfortable. It's horrible. We don't want to have to talk about this stuff every day. I get it. Like, I get why people don't want to talk about it. And I get why it's hard for people to say something, because then all their friends might be like, why are you talking about this? We don't want to talk about this. It's not even this, that, and the third, you know? It's really hard to sit in a reality that you don't want to be in. But it matters, you know.
This seems like an obvious thing to tie into your wonderful recent film, This Land. Looking at, of course, like we've been talking about, running as, you know, a political act, an act of self-empowerment and a way to take back public spaces that, you know, people of color have been excluded from and criminalized in. And so basically this film is around you running through a number of national monuments, so our public land, that were threatened. So tell us a little bit about that. Awesome film. We actually just sent it out in our Weiss Wolfpack newsletter the other day.
Thank you. Yeah. Essentially, yes, it's about running in public lands and raising awareness about the history of exclusion in these places. So we ran in Kafkaitsiskiyu National Monument here in Oregon, in Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah, and in Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks National Monument in New Mexico. And we chose those places because they were on the chopping block, so to speak, from the current administration and the former Secretary Zinke, who they were basically undoing the national monuments that Obama and Clinton had done. More complicated than that, but the film became very much about what it means to have a connection with our physical country, like our literal land, and the fact that we get to weigh in, we get to like have a say about access to green spaces. And in that film, we're going to some really incredibly epic, far away for a lot of people, places. But I think for me, it's about how do we change conservation, this like word that a lot of people don't feel like it doesn't resonate with them. How do we change it so that conservation is clean air, clean water, and access to green spaces, and therefore everyone feels like that matters for them. And it goes back to this idea of like, where can you be freely? Where can you be running? Where can you be, like, if you're sitting on a park bench, is that the sign that you're not dangerous? Like, is that the sign that it's okay because like the space is set up for recreation? Versus if you're on a corner, like, is that seen as like not okay? It's just so insane that we don't know how to be safe. Like, so the film gets into some questions of identity and some history. In this conversation and in all conversations, I really think that history is important because it shows that this isn't coming out of nowhere. It shows that this is ongoing. And so we brought some of the history of our public lands into the present conversation about public lands to be like, hey, like, weigh in on this, you know, you're a public landowner, like take ownership. And I think in general, like taking ownership is really important. I really wish that every person was writing to elected officials and going to public meetings because they have to listen. This is like a thing that I love and I feel like people don't know. Like if you contact them, they have to write down why. That's their job. So they write down who contacted them and what about. And sheer numbers can make all the difference. If enough people are saying, we need a crosswalk at blah, blah, blah street, and those people will not shut up about it because their kids are walking across that street to go to school, like, if they're loud enough, they care enough, they're going to get the crosswalk. Like, we know that on a small local level, but we don't see the same thing on this, like, widespread, like, you just have to stop killing Black people and not holding the people that kill them responsible. Like, that can't be the case. We're not going to stand for it anymore. Any of us. None of us.
And like, so do you believe...
care about it that much.
Do you believe that despite, you know, our entire country's history of systemic racism and these structures that have uphold that and continue to uphold that to this day, do you think that with enough shifting of public sentiment and collective action that the needle will move?
I do because I have to. Like, I can't live my life not believing that. And, you know, I think we talk somewhat about it in the film, but I've experienced racism in my own family that we've overcome. And so when I see that people can be better, people can be different, people can change on an individual level, then I believe that that can happen on a wider scale too, as a country.
I love that part of your story. Yeah. I remember that from the episode 4, of course, that part of your family history is really neat.
Thank you. Yeah, so I don't know. I do believe it, but it doesn't happen comfortably. Like, change hasn't happened comfortably ever. Because it means you're upsetting the status quo. And for the people who are already in charge, the status quo has worked really well for them. So, you know, they're not just going to give it up easily. Do you know how many people are upset any time that a police officer is accused of being racist, like, or having acted on unconscious bias based on preconceived racist prejudice? Like, you say that, and the ripple effect that goes through people is, at this point, that is more powerful than the outrage over the Black life that is lost every time. And that is why it hasn't changed. It's gotta...
You mean more people are outraged by that than are outraged by taking an innocent life by a police officer?
Yes, I absolutely think so. I think that every time someone is not held accountable, it tells us where we are as a country. It tells us, like, what we value and what we believe in and what progress we have or haven't made, because we are not outraged enough to hold these people accountable. We are much more willing to excuse this under some kind of lack of evidence, lack of credibility, unclear, information, mistakes, that's a more comfortable thing, because like you said, it's inconceivable that the people who are supposed to protect us are the ones that we're afraid are killing us, for some of us, but for other people, that reality is so inconceivable that they can't conceive of it because they don't live it. And so, but it's easier to conceive that a Black body is criminal because it's all we've ever seen. It's all we've ever been told. It's first of all what our country is founded on, because you had to dehumanize people in order to enslave them. So you had to say these people aren't actually human. They're not actually smart. They're not actually capable of self-government. They're not actually whatever. They're only good for labor, you know. And then the next part of that was, well, that remained, right? But then, you know, criminalization was an easier way to explain, well, yeah, we'll put those people in the slums. Yeah, we'll uproot them all and build, highways through their homes, and we won't help them get stabilized. Yeah, that place can get flooded and they can fend for themselves. It's easier for us to ignore needs and worthiness when we don't value people in the same way. And so when everything that we've grown up seeing just... You know, it's why I'm in film, because I think representation is really important. I think we need to see other stories, and we need to see people in a different light in order to stop othering them and stop making them strange and stop believing that they must somehow be deserving of their circumstances because they're different from us. But I think we still live in a country where that's what we think. So when we see bad things happen to other people, we are like, oh, they must somehow deserve that based on all the movies I saw growing up and all the books I read in school that skimmed over the historical facts that weren't pretty.
What, again, I'm not looking for any end all answer here, but as we start to wrap up, you know, what would you say to a well-meaning average person who maybe doesn't know, hasn't been super active or hasn't, you know, had this sort of thing on their radar that much for whatever reason, but they want to support stuff like this. They want to, you know, support justice and social justice. Like, what are the first steps for the beginner social justice person?
Yeah, it's so hard. I first of all, I acknowledge that it's really difficult to jump in to something that you don't know much about. And I think it can be really intimidating for people to want to do something. Like, how do I use my power and my privilege to do something? And they're afraid of doing it wrong. And so sometimes they don't do it at all. You know, for me, I think history is really important. So reading the stories of some people is really huge. Understanding Reconstruction, I actually wrote a huge thing about it that we can share that kind of shows how these laws came to be. I think the other thing, like I recently have become really curious about where Stand Your Ground laws exist still and how they, like I'm that's my next letter writing campaign is like, let's get rid of these Stand Your Ground laws because the fight against police brutality is a hard one. But the fight against random vigilantes killing people, like that should be really clear in my book, that that is not okay. There's a, so I don't know. I think getting better informed is really important. You know, talking about it, even though it's not comfortable, saying to people in your family, I've been thinking about Ahmaud Arbery this week. Have you? You know, that's hard to do, but it's a start. You know, it's like using those platforms, social media and real life. And then if you're in positions of power at work, bring it up in a meeting. Bring it up the next time you are doing something where there's donating to a cause or there's a community service day at your job. You know, and everybody wants to go do the one where you paint with kids or you, you know, pull up weeds or something. But where else can you go volunteer that has to do with social justice? So I don't know. I think getting more informed is really important. Supporting the efforts of Black and Indigenous people of color who are doing social justice work is really important. Talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the places where you work and play and are educated are really important, like holding institutions accountable to make a statement about it. You know, someone shared recently, they're like, every single company made a statement about COVID-19, multiple statements, because we see that as something that affects everyone, but we don't see this as someone that, something that affects everyone. And it does, like justifying murder affects everyone. So, you know, institutions can make a stand, and they should. So I don't know. I think that's, those are some steps, but it's certainly something I've been thinking about recently myself, because I feel like the question of what do I do comes up a lot. And write to your elected officials. Tweet at them. It doesn't even take that. It's not that hard. Like, yeah. Google, who are my elected officials? Write in your zip code and then tweet at them. That makes a difference. Like, I think, I don't know. I know all mine here in Oregon, and they know me at this point. And that's so cool. Like, yeah. I never thought that was possible. I'm into it.
That's great. And you, yeah. Of course, are a writer and have done some recent writings, one specifically about the Ahmaud Arbery situation. So we can link some of those in the show notes as well.
Yeah. Thank you. It's, I think runners are also trying to figure out what they can do. And I think some people don't want to politicize the thing that is like fun for you. But it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I think it's important. I think I like to say everyone should have something to be a broken record about.
Well, and the reason running is fun for people is because it's such a sense of freedom and a sense of, in you know, being in touch with your body and and moving and all these wonderful, wonderful elemental things about being a human.
Yeah.
And so then there, that reinforces the whole point of, to not feel comfortable recreating freely in public space is something that we all should be fighting for.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Well, we are very grateful for you, Faith. Thank you so much. Thank you for all the work you do and the films you make. They're wonderful, really important stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate that you're always tackling uncomfortable subjects, you know. Even when we don't know how, it's still really important to try. So thanks so much for having me and being a friend and a co-conspirator.
Hell yeah, it's an honor. Have a wonderful day. We'll have you on again soon talking about something else. Getting more of your wisdom.
Sounds great.
Okay. All right, talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
This wraps up another edition of
the Get After It PDX podcast.
For more information about today's guest, including social media links, please check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn to get out there
and get after it.